From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
In 2017, more than 3,000 Australians committed suicide, and the suicide figure has been steadily rising over the past decade. Scott Morrison has declared suicide prevention a key priority for his government, and he's appointed Christine Morgan to lead the effort. Ms. Morgan is the CEO of the National Mental Health Commission, and now she's the National Suicide Prevention Advisor to the Prime Minister. Before that, she was CEO of the Butterfly Foundation for Eating Disorders, and earlier she worked for Wesley Mission after a career in the corporate sector. Currently, the Mental Health Commission is conducting an Australia-wide tour to inform itself ahead of a 2030 vision for an improved mental health and suicide prevention system. Christine Morgan, can we start by looking at the extent and causes of what seems almost a suicide epidemic in Australia? How extensive is suicide in this country now compared with previous decades?
That is a really interesting question, Michelle, because I think one of the challenges that we have, it's generally accepted across the sector, is we need to significantly increase our ability to gather data so we can answer that question. So what do we know? What we know is that the 3,128 deaths by suicide in 2017, which was the last reported period, was an increase. So we certainly know that. What we don't have absolute clarity on is how many people attempted suicide. And that is a very important question because that goes towards that whole idea of suicide ideation. And we don't have too much insight into, is this a rapidly increasing inverted commas epidemic or what else is happening? So that's one of the very real challenges we have. But we certainly know that the 3,128 deaths was an increase, and that's something we're all concerned about.
So if we look into the past, maybe some of the increase is due to greater awareness or different ways of collecting figures and so on. But if we think there's a real increase, what do you think are the main causes of this over a period, over a decade, over two or three decades?
Yeah, so really I'm hearing that question is if we're looking at those who have suicide ideation, mm-hmm. or those who attempt or those yes. who complete, what's bringing them to that point of complete despair and giving up hope? Because I think that's the common end point that people are at when this seems the way out. And we in the past have looked very much at this from a health, mental health perspective, but I think what we're now really trying to grab hold of is to say, if you're looking at that journey for somebody to end up in that position, then yes, it may be that they're suffering from a mental health condition. Yes, they may be suffering from a health condition, but they may also be being affected by other things which significantly impact, like what is their housing security? Are they homeless? Are they at risk of losing their homes? What is their employment situation? What's their financial situation? Have they come from a background of trauma? What are some of those other, what I would call upstream factors, which are significant in somebody's journey, that when you look at them on a cumulative basis might well lead them to that point of despair? Because one of the challenges we have, Michelle, is that a very significant proportion of those who die by suicide have not actually come in contact with the health or mental health service. So what is happening?
So we'll look at the youth problem specifically in a minute, but what preventive measures can our workplaces and the community take to tackle this issue?
It's one of the things I'm looking at doing a deep dive in, but can I say up front that from the consultations I've been doing with communities just over the last few weeks, it does seem to me that a solution here has to be focused in community. If we look at the basis of saying how do we really step in to identify when somebody's starting to go down this pathway or get into a place where they're actively contemplating, the answer seems to be in our relationships with each other. And what communities are saying to me, and I think they've got a very valid point here, is we know our people. we can get alongside them. We work with them, we do sport with them, we have coffees with them. We probably can pick up those subtle nuances that are happening for them before others can. So I think one of the key things we need to do is look at how can we better resource our communities to be able to have those conversations, know what signs to look for, and know what to do. And in that space, I think workplaces is a really important community because it is one where many, many Australians are in their workplaces for a significant portion of each day.
On the other hand, don't you think that communities and even workplaces are in a way more fragmented these days? We've got more family breakdown. We've got more busy families where people do their work and then they need to get off to other commitments that they have. We've got less community cohesion in neighbourhoods. So doesn't all this work against communities being able to provide the support that's needed?
You certainly have very eloquently pinpointed a challenge in 2019. And interestingly, communities are acknowledging that very thing back to me, Michelle. They're saying, gosh, we've moved away from what we want to be as communities, because what we want to be as communities is fundamentally based on relationship. And each of those issues that you've just touched on is where our relationship connectivity is breaking down. So I think if we're going to look for communities to be a point to help us find some solutions, then one of the fundamental things we will need to do is to go back into communities and say, well, look, in 2019, when we have all of these time constraints, when we have social media, which has acted as a real disconnector in many ways, it seems to think it's a connector, but actually there's a lot of disconnecting. What are those very fundamental things we need to do in community to enable us to be community? So being community is actually one of the challenges.
Let's turn to young people. Do you think that young people these days are more prone to be really disillusioned with their lives, to feel that they can't cope with the things they face? Do you think that we need to get into schools better to identify people who are vulnerable and build more resilience generally?
I think I'd have to say yes to all of those, because we certainly are seeing higher rates of reported anxiety, depression, stress, those kind of things with our young people. Part of that, of course, could be because they are becoming more familiar with them as concepts and if you like, identifying that those are challenges. But the answer is yes, they are feeling them. And in terms of should we go into schools, absolutely. In fact, I was talking to one of our commissioners last night about this very real intersect that we need to create of being able to go into schools, which is kind of the education framework, with programs that have positive health outcomes. And as I said to her, one of the interesting challenges would be to say, if you can get more positive health outcomes amongst our young people, if you can help them develop the resilience you were talking about, if you can help them find ways to address their anxiety, their stress, and other mental health challenges, then the assumption has to be you're also going to get better education outcomes. But the interesting point of the conversation was to go into schools means actually taking programs that may not necessarily be education focused, but that's the community where we need to go into. So how do we get those portfolios really working together?
Now, you spoke about social media and you were stressing that, or suggesting that it could be a negative rather than a positive influence. And I think many parents would see it that way too, and others. Just talk us through the implications of social media and how families can cope with it so that it doesn't have this negative effect.
Leaping to that last one, I think it's a really important question. So coming back to your first one, which is really what is it we're dealing with? When you look at the Industrial Revolution, etc., they were defined as revolutions because what was being implemented touched every stratum of society. How we speak to each other, how we communicate, how we live our lives, how we educate ourselves, how we work, every way. And I think that's what technology has done. So it's a reality. We can't ignore it. What is it doing in a social media sense? I think it's doing a few things. I think it is making conversation very real, very fast, and not only enabling, but in many instances requiring people to have very instinctive, in-the-moment reactions, comments, disclosures, etc. So I think it has changed us from a more contemplative way of discussing things with each other to an immediate, if you like, short thought bubbles and bursts of conversation. I think secondly and most importantly, it has created a degree of anonymity which enables this horror of cyberbullying to be a reality for far too many of our young Australians. And I think thirdly, it's created almost a false sense of connectivity. When you look at, you know, what has to date anyway been the case of likes, dislikes and that kind of thing through Instagram and the rest of it, they use words which we have in the past associated with friendship and connectedness, but is really actually quite false. It's not that. It's just this immediate like, dislike or whatever. And it's not really based on relationship. It's based on just a different form of communication. So I think it purports to be a way of connecting people. It purports to be a way of encouraging good communication, but it's doing it in such a way that it's actually resulting, I think, in some real harm. And how can we address it? I don't think we can't get rid of it. It's a reality. I think we can certainly encourage families to regulate. I think that's a really good self-regulation. And most importantly, I think we have to go back to our young people and teach them new skills of media literacy, not the old ones, but the new ones, and being able to say to them, this is the reality of this environment. This is what they're trying to encourage in terms of conversation. Stop, think. How do you want to engage rather than finding yourself caught up in something where you're just reacting?
So do you think that in terms of suicide attempts, there is a significant number of young people who go this path because of bullying?
I don't know the exact correlation between that, Michelle, but I do know that what I do feel comfortable saying is that despair, grief, nowhere to go, involves a considerable amount of feelings of social isolation. And the end product of some of the horrific stories we hear about cyberbullying is somebody feeling completely socially isolated. So I think it would have to be saying that in this conversation about what are we looking at for preventing suicide ideation, suicide attempts, we cannot ignore that social media space and what is happening in terms of cyberbullying.
Another big area, of course, that leads many people into very dark places is drugs. What do you think is the most effective way of trying to deal with this?
Oh, dear. I think that's a bit like asking me, how do we solve world hunger? Because when I am doing these community consults across Australia, the harsh reality is that drugs are truly there in so many communities, and they're causing incredible disintegration of community, disintegration of family, disintegration of relationships, and I suspect adding to, certainly in the case of alcohol, impulsivity of behaviours. So it's a societal issue, it's a deep issue, and again, if I'm looking at what are going to be those longer term policy things that will influence us, we can't take away the role of communities. So I can't tell you I've got a formulated answer on that one, Michelle, but I can say that is it a critical thing for us all to consider? Yes, it's happening in communities. We need to look at what the heck can we do to try and address it at that level.
Now, in the budget, more than $500 million was allocated to youth mental health and suicide prevention. Can you give us an idea where this money is going to be spent and what's the evidence base for choosing that direction or directions?
The directions for it, yes. Well, look, a significant part of it will go out through our increasing the reach and the ability to respond quickly of our Headspace centres. Interestingly, again, as I've gone around the country and talked with communities, Headspace now is a very well recognised brand for our young people, and there's a general feel of you know, there may be some things we can do to further improve the model of service delivery from Headspace. There may be some questions that we can ask around an expanded role for Headspace or an appropriate fit-for-purpose role for Headspace and community. But the one thing I'm hearing is the value of that brand for our young people in being able to say, I need help and this is a place I can go, is very, very important. So we're certainly looking at that. We're looking at what can we do in terms of child mental health and the preventative work that we might be able to bring in at that place, going right into pregnancy and perinatal kind of areas as well. And we're looking at what can be done in terms of early childhood psychosis and those areas. So they're initiatives that are very that are evidence-based, that are looking at how can we expand that reach to our young people. But as I say, that's just but part of the issue. When we look at suicide prevention, it's our young people, but it's also our males in their 40 to 55 year age range, and it's our increasing numbers of women as well.
Just on Headspace, there are some who say that it's been getting too large a slice of the available money. Do you think that criticism is valid?
I think it is a criticism we need to look at, and we should never be beyond asking the question of what is the return that we're getting for that investment. So I certainly think that continuing to ask the question of what return we're getting is important. The conversation I'm having as I talk with people is, firstly, is there value in Headspace? And it's coming back with a resounding yes, there absolutely is. This is what Headspace has done to date in terms of clinical service delivery. Is that good? Yes. What is the future for Headspace is where we have that interesting dialogue. And I think that is happening because if you look at what has happened over the last 10 years, the community awareness and ability to talk about mental health has increased significantly. We do see numbers of young people in particular coming forward for help. But what do we do about being able to answer need is a systemic real issue, and Headspace has certainly got a role to play in that.
Just to look at a couple of other vulnerable cohorts, the suicide rate among Indigenous Australians is more than double the rate of the rest of the community or the community generally. What do you see as the best way of tackling this? You've been stressing that everything is connecting to everything else and there's no one solution to the general situation, but this is even more so, isn't it, in the case of Indigenous people. How do you see the way forward?
So the way forward, and you're absolutely right, so I think that the call across the Indigenous community is reinvestment in kinship, and I think there's a general recognition of that, of enabling those communities to be as strong and as resilient as they can be. I do think we need to look at why is it that young Indigenous people in particular seem to reach that point where of despair, where this becomes, in their eyes, the way to proceed. We do need to look at that. So we need to look at what is happening for those young people. We need desperately to look at, I think, those social determinants for our Indigenous people, that their housing security, their food security, their own identity, you know, the identity of an Indigenous man in his 40s is incredibly significant. And if that identity has been disintegrated, then what does that do in terms of vulnerability for a number of things, including the potential for suicide? So we certainly need to look at the social determinants across it. We need to enable those communities to, as across all communities in Australia, to find their own solutions. We need to be incredibly respectful of their culture, their language, and their concept of what it means to be mentally healthy and mentally well. Because for our Indigenous population, even the two words mental health is something that is not a familiar concept for them.
Obviously, unemployed people are also very vulnerable. How do you see the solution here? And what's your view on increasing Newstart or the pressure to increase Newstart? Would this help, or are the problems at a different level?
So putting to one side, I'm not going to wait. I don't believe I'm in a position to get engaged in the economics of Newstart or where it is or those kind mm-hmm. of issues. I think certainly where I can talk to is that being in a position where, as an individual, you feel you can and are making a contribution is incredibly important for our own sense of identity. And in our cultural terms, employment is a very significant way of feeling that we are making a contribution. So any and all initiatives that are looking at how can we encourage people to be engaging in contributing, for most of us that would mean, at least for a large segment of our life, being in the workforce, how can we encourage that is incredibly important. The economics of the mechanisms the government uses for that is, I think, a separate issue. The fundamental principle holds true, which is that the opportunity to contribute in worthwhile employment is something that most Australians would aspire to.
So this would make people who, say, lose their jobs in their 50s, you've spoken about older men a couple of times, they would be particularly devastated by that situation?
Certainly what you would say on that, Michelle, is if you have somebody who suddenly loses their employment in their 50s, that would be a point where you would say, I need to just connect in there, because, yes, my view is that is a time of vulnerability, particularly if it's not a time of transition that has been managed, but is something that somebody else has just been thrust upon them. And with many of these things, it's where you have a sense of, I'm not in control. I've lost my job not because I'm in my 50s and I'm choosing to take early retirement, but I've lost my job because of X and I feel out of control. I don't know where to go. What does it mean for me? How does that impact on who I am as a person? They're the trigger points we need to look at if we're trying to do this through a suicide prevention lens.
Also, the same trigger points for veterans, don't they? Because a lot of these people seem to be getting into a lot of mental problems these days.
Certainly. And being the daughter of somebody who was a long-time serving defence member, I know at first hand the impact that these things can have on the mental health and well-being of somebody who's been in the Defence Forces, who has perhaps served or perhaps not served, and what is the impact of signing up and not serving on somebody's vulnerabilities. So certainly, and there are good things that are happening with the Department of Defence, the Department of Veteran Affairs being very focused in on what are the particular needs of our vets and how can we ensure that the scaffolding around them that we can provide them when they're actively in the Defence Force can also continue when they've moved across into other parts of their lives.
Now, just finally, you've spoken about your consultations that are ongoing and you're travelling around Australia. Just how do people connect with what you're doing with those consultations?
Thank you. And that's really work which is coming out of my role as CEO of the National Mental Health Commission. But and that work is looking at visioning what it would be to have a mental health and suicide prevention system which actually meets real need in real time. So in order to do that piece of work for our federal health minister, part of that process has been how can we do a grassroots consultation with Australians in their communities to see what that may look like. And so obviously in that place, we're dealing not only with mental health but with suicide prevention. So it's been a great time for that kind of conversation. For people to get engaged in that conversation with us, the best place to do so is through the Mental Health Commission website. The project is called Connections because we believe that's a fundamental underlying principle of what we need. And there are a few mechanisms where if somebody is in one of the communities where we're going into for consultation, we would welcome them at our town hall meetings. But there is also an online survey, which we can encourage any Australian to do, which can be found on the website and is an opportunity for people to give us not only their stories of things that aren't working right, but what we are really encouraging is what are your innovative thoughts for what could be ways forward for us to improve the system.
Well, I'm sure many people will want to connect with that work. Christine Morgan, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all from today's Conversation Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Rushna Farooq. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.